Chapter 12, The Progressive Era. Chapter Preview, People. James Buchanan Duke, Coleman Blease, Robert M. La Follette, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, Woodrow Wilson, W.E.B. Du Bois, Ida B. Wells Barnett, Duncan Clinch Hayward, Martin F. Ansel, Richard I. Manning, Julius Rosenwald, Virginia Durant Young, Susan Pringle Frost, Anita Politzer, Eulalie Chafee Sally, Freddie Stowers, Bernard Baruch. Places: Newberry, Sumter, Rock Hill, Myrtle Beach, North Augusta, Sandy Springs. Americans born in 1865 would have observed some amazing and revolutionary changes in their lifetime. Soon after their birth, the typewriter was invented and writing became a lot easier and easier to read. At about the same time, the Transcontinental Railroad, binding America's East Coast with the new golden promise of the West Coast, was completed. Then the telephone was invented, and soon a voice could be heard through wires across the continent. Electricity had been known in the form of lightning from the beginning of humankind, but learning to generate electricity and harness it to create light and run machinery happened in the early 1880s. Soon cities and towns were brightly lit at night. By 1893, Columbia, South Carolina had the world's first all-electric cotton mill. Soon after that, all kinds of factories were powered by electricity. Humans had learned how to expand their capacity to do work far beyond what human and animal power could ever do. By the time those Americans reached age 30, they had news that several different inventors were attempting to put gasoline-powered motors on buggies. The automobile revolutionized transportation in the 20th century. If the gasoline engine could power a car, why not add wings and fly? Before they were 40, they could read about airplanes in newspapers, even if they didn't actually fly in them. Another invention of the 1890s that people could read or hear about was the moving picture. Still photographs had advanced to moving pictures and recorded music in a hurry. If they had surgery, anesthesia was available to soothe their pain. If they lived to the ripe old age of 50, the radio was sending voice messages through the air, no wires. Who knew there were radio waves in the air all around? Americans born in 1865 were too old to fight in World War I, but they heard about the use of airplanes, submarines, tanks, and poison gas. They could only view with awe the new world they were living in. Section 1. Life at the Turn of the Century. As you read, look for how the new wave of immigrants reshaped America, but led to a backlash against them. The pleasures and problems of rural life in South Carolina. Reasons for the growing prosperity of farmers in our state. Technological advances that improved life in towns and cities. The effects of disease and violence on South Carolinians. Terms: rural free delivery, RFD, hydroelectric, streetcar, trolley, pandemic, pellagra. Life in America and in South Carolina around the turn of the century was affected by great technological changes, but life was also still affected by age-old factors that had shaped American life for centuries. One of these factors was the interaction of European culture with black culture and American Indian culture. That interaction created a unique civilization that was neither European, nor African, nor Native American. South Carolina and other Deep South states experienced the greatest influence from African cultures simply because the huge numbers of Africans who had been imported as slaves were able to pass on more of their culture. Another factor is related to the first. America continued to be influenced by waves of immigrants adding their flavors to American life. In the years from 1880 to 1920, millions of foreigners poured into the country. Most of the new immigrants did not come to South Carolina. They were not attracted to the state's struggling agriculture or its new mills. More people were moving out of South Carolina than were moving in. Of the 1.4 million people in South Carolina in 1900, only 5,528 were foreign-born. Some of those, however, made significant contributions to the state, such as the Gonzalez family from Cuba. N.G., Ambrose, and William Gonzalez were journalists who established the State newspaper in 1891. Resistance to immigration. Not all Americans welcomed the new immigrants who arrived after 1880. Instead of appreciating the immigrants' economic muscle and cultural contributions, many resented the foreigners' acceptance of lower wages. Resentment first hit the Chinese, who had been brought into the West to work on railroads and in mines. In 1882, Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, the first effort to totally shut America's doors to any foreign group. The next immigrants to suffer discrimination were from Eastern and Southern Europe. Soon after World War I, this nativist, favoring native inhabitants over immigrants, sentiment resulted in passage of the most restrictive immigration legislation in our history. Those laws of the 1920s placed limits on the number of immigrants who could settle in America each year. Only 150,000 were allowed in any year, compared to the previous average of 1 million per year. Most of the new immigrants had to come from Western Europe, very few from Eastern Europe, and none from Asia. These restrictions lasted until the 1960s. Rural life in South Carolina. Immigration seldom bothered South Carolina. Most Carolinians lived in small houses scattered along dirt roads with few close neighbors. Some families owned land, but most were tenants or sharecroppers. Almost all were poor. Diversions. Life was tough, but not without pleasure. There were families to raise and joy to be found in happy children's faces. The women had quilting bees with their neighbors and baked pies to take to the annual county fair. Men enjoyed hunting coons and rabbits, racing horses and mules, watching cockfights, and drinking whiskey, perhaps distilled from their own corn. They enjoyed sitting with their friends, talking and chewing tobacco. Both men and women enjoyed church on Sundays and the occasional church picnics. Churches continued to be Southern, separate from Northern churches, and separated by race. Churches were growing and active during the 1880 to 1920 period. Despite few resources, they sent missionaries and created orphanages. They preached passionately against drinking, and they promoted prohibition of alcoholic beverages by state action. Camp meetings focused on individual sin and salvation. The preachers, especially in white churches, tended to neglect social sins such as child labor, the convict lease system, racism, and extreme poverty. The country store. Before the automobile and good roads, the country store was an important institution. Located at a crossroads or in a village or small town, it was usually a large two-story building. The store sold food, work clothes, kerosene, candles, tools, and farm tools. It sold the ever-present patent medicines not prescribed by a doctor, that were supposed to cure everything from stomachache to ingrown toenails. Most of them were useless, but they were popular. Many contained a high alcoholic content, which might explain their popularity. At least one patent medicine available by the end of the century was worth its cost. Aspirin, truly a pain reliever. The country store often served as a post office and meeting place for such white organizations as the Grange, the Farmers Alliance, Tillman's Farmers Association, the local Democratic Party, or the Masonic Lodge. At election time, the store might serve as a polling place, but more often it was an informal social gathering place. Men liked to meet their friends by the pot-bellied stove in winter or on the shady porch in summer and talk about the news of the day. The store owner functioned as a banker as well as a merchant, extending credit to farmers. Sometimes the farmers fell into such heavy debt that they had to turn over their farms to the merchant and become renters or sharecroppers. This happened many times in the 1880s and 1890s, but better times were coming. Farm life improves. Agriculture in South Carolina was generally prosperous, and farm life improved in the first two decades of the 20th century. Tobacco cultivation soared in the PD area, which proved to be the only region of the state that was perfect for growing bright leaf tobacco for cigarettes. In 1890, the PD produced 220,000 pounds of tobacco. 10 years later, the area produced 20 million pounds. Farmers growing tobacco could make at least three times as much profit per acre as those growing cotton. Cotton crops increased during the first decade, peaking at an all-time high of 1.6 million bales in 1911. Surprisingly, the price the farmers received also went up a bit. In 1914, cotton was bringing 13 cents per pound, a decent price. World War I began that year in Europe and spurred demand for cotton products, such as uniforms and tents. Cotton prices went up sharply. Encouraged by new demand, farmers bought more land and equipment on credit. The price of cotton went to 40 cents per pound in 1920. Most farmers were feeling pretty good. Rural free delivery. An important innovation by the federal government improved life for all rural residents. Beginning gradually after 1902, the government established rural free delivery, RFD, routes for delivery of mail directly to rural areas that had never experienced mail delivery before. Mail order stores such as Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward now mailed thick catalogs to farm families. The families could order things they never knew they needed, and all could be brought to them by RFD. Farmers did not just buy fanciful items from the catalogs. They could buy tools and plows, windmills and weather vanes, lanterns and lightning rods. One could even purchase a house in a kit, which would be shipped by RFD. The mail order companies cut into the profits of country stores, very much as internet stores in the 21st century are challenging local merchants. But competition brought more choices and better prices. Villages and towns. Small towns and villages were a part of the rural scene. All had hitching rails, watering troughs, and livery stables for horses and mules. All the roads were dirt. Most towns had a little hotel with a place to eat, though local people seldom ate out. The towns had stores, cotton gins, churches, a doctor or two, and often a railroad. Saturday was come-to-town day for farmers. The townspeople enjoyed the same leisure time activities as farmers, but more organized activities were possible. Baseball had become popular since Union troops brought the sport south. By the turn of the century, every town, mill village, and college had to have a baseball team, and fans were truly fanatical. A city like Charleston had a professional team. Smaller towns had semi-pro and amateur teams. The most intense competition was among the mill villages of the upcountry. Mill owners recruited the best players to work and play on their teams. Towns provided parks, bandstands, spelling bees, horse races, cockfights, and parades for special holidays. That holiday would not be the 4th of July. Former Confederates were not yet ready to celebrate American independence. A few towns built opera houses or civic buildings where traveling actors and musicians performed. Opera was not the usual fare. Some of these beautiful structures have been refurbished recently. They are, again, providing a cultural boost to their communities, notably in Newberry, Abbeville, Sumter, and Marion. Advances in technology, the telephone and electricity. Life for many was transformed by technological changes. The telephone was invented in 1876, and by the end of the century, many townspeople were hearing a woman ask, "Number, please?" A new job opportunity for women was born, telephone operator. Electricity was not far behind. In the 1880s, the user of electrical power had to be located very close to the generating plant, as was the case in Columbia's first all-electric cotton mill in 1893. The mill was only 600 feet from the hydroelectric, producing electricity by water power, plant on the Columbia Canal. When electricity could travel by wire for long distances, the use of electric power increased. South Carolina figured large in that development. The first significant distant transmission in the South came when the Portman Shoals hydroelectric plant on the Seneca River sent current 10 miles to Anderson. The lights came on and the mill machinery whirred in 1898. Anderson acquired the nickname the Electric City, which it has kept to the present. Soon, North Carolina tobacco tycoon James Buchanan Duke began building a series of hydroelectric plants on the Catawba Watery River system. Duke Power Company was born. Other companies began damming other rivers and producing electricity. Most cities and larger towns in the state converted from gas to electric street lights in the 1880s and 1890s. Not many houses were connected to electricity until about 1900. Rural residents had to wait several more decades for the electrical revolution to reach them. Several cities provided public transportation on streetcars, passenger vehicles that ran on rails and were pulled by mules. By the end of the century, Charleston, Columbia, Spartanburg, Anderson, and Greenville had replaced them with trolleys, streetcars that ran on power from overhead wires. These cities could expand in size, link up with mill villages on the outskirts, and connect new suburbs with the downtown jobs and shopping. Early in the 20th century, railroads were still the most convenient form of land transportation, both within cities and between towns. 28 passenger trains and 38 freight trains served Columbia every day, but cars were coming on strong. The automobile. When cars were invented in the 1890s, they were only for the wealthy, costing nearly $1,000. Those who wanted a windshield paid extra. By 1904, Columbia had about 50 autos, or horseless carriages. Many city streets and almost all rural roads were unpaved, muddy messes, almost impassable for cars. Local, state, and federal governments would later take up the burden of building better roads. Horses and carriages were to be around for several decades, despite horses being terrified by the noisy cars whipping by at 8 or 10 miles per hour. In 1917, when the United States entered World War I, South Carolina had 40,000 cars and terrible road conditions. few bridges had been built over major rivers, so ferry boats had to haul cars across. Look at a map and estimate how many rivers you would have to ferry while driving from Charleston to Beaufort. Most American cars were manufactured in Detroit, Michigan, but South Carolina had one early venture in making automobiles. John Gary Anderson, a buggy manufacturer in Rock Hill, converted his plant in 1916 to produce cars. Over the next 10 years, the company made 6,300 cars, mostly of the luxury variety, but it went bankrupt in 1926. Ford, not Anderson, became the household name because Henry Ford developed the efficient assembly line that enabled him to produce a basic car to sell for about $400. The Anderson, a bigger car, cost 4 to 6 times as much. Tourism. As more and more wealthy Northerners discovered South Carolina as an attractive place to spend their winters, the trains brought them in, not cars. Many of the tourists came to enjoy sports associated with horses. Aiken and Camden, in particular, developed brisk tourist businesses with luxury hotels and expensive second homes. There were harness races with trotting horses pulling small buggies and steeplechases for high-jumping thoroughbreds. Polo and fox hunting were also popular. The beach was not yet well developed as a tourist destination. In 1900, a railroad was built from Conway to the beach, where there was a farm and a cotton gin. In a naming contest, Myrtle Beach was selected because of the numerous wax myrtle shrubs near the beach. In 1901, the first hotel was built there. The price was right. $2 per night included 3 meals, but no electricity or running water. There is little wonder that northern tourists did not yet flock to South Carolina's Grand Strand. Health. South Carolina was not the healthiest place to live in 1900. 1/3 of the state's young men volunteering for the Spanish-American War in 1898 were not accepted into the Army because of health problems. Killer diseases such as smallpox, malaria, and typhoid still took their toll. Vaccination for smallpox had been available for over a century, but resistance was considerable, especially in the mill villages. Mill workers did not want government or health officials telling them to get shots. But state government did make vaccinations compulsory, and by 1930, smallpox had been eliminated. The most dramatic health problem, not just in South Carolina, but around the world, was the influenza, flu, epidemic of 1918 and 1919. This outbreak was a pandemic, a worldwide epidemic, in which 26 million people died. In South Carolina, about 10% of the population got the flu, resulting in over 14,000 deaths from the flu or pneumonia. A less deadly but more lasting problem in South Carolina was pellagra. First diagnosed in the mid-18th century, pellagra was a disease that caused diarrhea, mental depression, and skin disorders that left permanent bleached-out blotches on the skin. Mill villages had the highest rate of pellagra. Studies in Spartanburg County mills supported the idea that poverty and poor diet caused the disease. Poorer workers were 12 times more likely to get pellagra than the higher-paid workers who could afford a better diet. Mill hands tended to eat a steady diet of cornmeal, salt pork, and molasses. Add green vegetables, milk, eggs, and fresh meat, and the disease did not occur. When World War I brought higher wages, pellagra nearly ended. When economic hard times returned in the 1920s, the disease came roaring back. Finally, in the late 1930s, researchers found the exact problem, the lack of niacin, a form of B vitamin in the diet. With this knowledge, the disease has ceased to occur in most of the world. Violence and murder. one of the unhealthiest and ugliest aspects of South Carolina in the turn-of-the-century era was the rate of violence and murder. America had always been a violent country, perhaps because of its frontier beginnings. On the frontier, personal disputes were often settled quickly and with violence rather than an appeal to law. The South had traditionally been violent. Then Civil War and Reconstruction unleashed a rebellion against the established order, showing approval of the illegal use of violence. A South Carolina newspaper blamed the bloodshed on liquor and guns, but they were only part of the story. Another part of the story was the acceptance of murder by so many South Carolinians. During the 1890s, South Carolina had 7 members in the U.S. House of Representatives. 4 of the 7 had killed a man. In 1903, N.G. Gonzalez, editor of the state newspaper, was gunned down on the sidewalk across from the State House in Columbia in broad daylight before several witnesses. His attacker was Jim Tillman, Lieutenant Governor and nephew of Senator Ben Tillman. A jury found Jim Tillman not guilty of murder. Do you remember? 1. Define in sentence form Rural Free Delivery, RFD, Hydroelectric, Pandemic. 2. What were some of the functions of the country store and the store owner? 3. What were some of the sports associated with horses that tourists to South Carolina enjoyed?